kids. Matt Segundo here, and I have some very sad news to report. It's not quite as sad as the current state of my tequila supply, but it's pretty damn close. It seems that some interloper, an inveterate rogue named Edward Champion, decided to produce and record 5 separate podcasts without consulting me. Something called the Litblog Co-op, which I presume is some Bolshevik outfit. I wouldn't know. Anyway, these podcasts were made and neither Jorge nor myself were asked to contribute. But in an effort to bridge the gap and promote understanding, to not confuse our dear listeners and avoid non-binding arbitration, these shows have been edited together into Bat Segundo's segments. If you've heard them before, you're not missing much, save the stunning intonations of my voice right now. But if you haven't heard these interviews, understand that this Edward Champion character, if that is indeed his real name, sounds an awful lot like our young roving correspondent. I suspect foul play. I suspect collusion. I suspect a gunman on the grassy knoll. One thing's for sure, Jorge and I won't take this nefarious treatment sitting down. But in the meantime, please enjoy, if that can in fact be the proper verb, Ander Monson and Elizabeth Crane, and pop back a cold one or 4 for your dear, beloved, and neglected bat.
19 lip bloggers. 1 finalist. 5 nominees. 1, finalist. 5 authors. 1 podcaster. 5 Mondays. 5 interviews. 1 podcast. Anyway, the hell with it. It's the LBC Podcast! Hello out there and welcome to a new and emerging podcast here at the Litblog Co-op. Welcome to an unusual experiment. What we are going to be doing over the next 5 Mondays is something extraordinarily exciting. Perhaps not as animated as the present sort of timbre would sort of suggest, but nevertheless, I would think fairly exciting, groundbreaking. Enough of that. I just want a few people out there to hopefully bust some pinatas and, you know, smoke them if they got them. Hi there, my name is Edward Champion. I am the lit blogger behind Return of the Rockdent. I also run a literary podcast called The Bat Segundo Show, and what we are seeing here is convergence, baby. Over the next 5 Mondays, I will be talking with the 5 octorial nominees for this quarter. And not only that, but I will also be talking with the 5 fantastic, lovely nominators who actually brought these books to our attention. So, if you read their lit blogs, you will then be able to match the voice with the lip block. Isn't this exciting? First off, I apologize for my enthusiasm. I don't quite know how to introduce these things, but it needs an introduction. Anyway, our first nominee, is Ander Monson. And he wrote a book called Other Electricities, which is this fantastic sort of various interconnected stories. It's one of the few pieces of fiction you will read that actually has an index. He has also written a book called Vacation Land, which is a book of poetry. Anyway, Mr. Monson talked with me, and I should first of all let you know that when I talked with him, I was operating off of 3 hours of sleep, and I had also run out of coffee, and I had to call him, and there was some mathematical problems with the time zone change and all that, as I learned, as you'll hear. So I apologize on behalf of myself as you listen to it. Ander, great guy, nice guy, thoughtful guy, had a lot to say. We talked about a lot of things. You'll hear that in just a minute. But before we go there, I want to introduce one fantastic hell of a guy. His name is Sam Jones, and he runs the fantastic Chicago-based literary weblog, Golden Rule Jones. Sam, I was wondering if you could tell the world exactly why it was, what was it that about Monson that sort of spoke to you?
Well, you know what, I actually wrote on the LBC lip blog a little bit about how I discovered Monson one night. Just walked into the bookstore looking for something entirely new, never heard of him, never seen a book before in my life, and I just, you know, after going through about 1,000 books, kind of picked this one up, and it's just an amazing book. I had been talking about it for 6 months or so, and I thought, gosh, you know, now my time to nominate came rolling around. Can I be continuing to talk about Ander Monson even now? And I looked at another couple of dozen books that came out this year, and it's still absolutely the best book that I've read in the last year. You know, it's got a really novel, experimental form. It's very funny. It covers a, I think, area of the country that is probably underrepresented, I think we can say, in fiction. And it's just a complete one-of-a-kind book, and just very compelling, moving, funny read.
And it's also educational for native Californians like me who don't understand this snowplow and all this jazz.
Yeah, snow plays a very big role in this book.
Yes.
It's probably the best book written about snow in about 300 years.
Yes. take that, Orhan Pamuk.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't include that.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Sam. Okay, so I am here, and I'm talking with Ander Monson, author of Other Electricities. How are you doing, Ander?
Doing quite well.
You just edumacated me in terms of the whole time zone change. For some reason, I thought that Michigan was 2 hours ahead as opposed to 3 hours. But thank you for talking to me all the same.
Not a problem.
There seems to be a very interesting effort on your part to sort of present characters and their sort of emotional kind of struggles, people falling in lakes and the like, and it seems to be very sort of distinct and separate from the conceptual. And I'm wondering what steps you take to sort of get that particular tone.
I guess, could you talk a little bit more about that question? I'm not sure I exactly understand it.
Well, okay. On one hand, in Other Electricities, you have charts, diagrams, a very helpful index, by the way.
But
at the same time, there, you know, when you actually sift into the stories themselves, what sort of conscious efforts you make as a writer to separate, you know, the organization of information as opposed to, you know, concentrating on the actual characters' visceral needs, their motivations, and the like.
I think the book is obviously structurally pretty innovative, and there's this whole kind of sieve of, just as a way of filtering the information and a lot of the emotional weight of the actual pieces themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was looking for, I do think of them as being sort of separate. I took a couple different tactics when I was working on the book in the first place to try to find a way around simply just writing sort of regular short stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think what the sort of like contemporary realist short story, which doesn't interest me, and I'm also pretty bad at writing them. So what I was trying to do is both to represent, I guess, this oppressive weight, which, you know, most of the stories are fairly dark, a little bit grotesque.
Yeah.
There's certainly an elegiac tone happening in at least, the central stories that all involve death,
mm-hmm.
although I hope there are a few light spots there, too. And so what I was trying to do is almost all the stories are composed in first person as almost these dramatic monologues,
yeah.
which is the way that that I've found most useful to reveal the characters' mindset and just kind of get inside them in a way. So, you know, it'd actually be interesting to see this book staged in some way, because I think you could pretty easily.
Well,
although I've never really thought about that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I am also kind of curious about, did you have a sort of universal plan when you were devising these stories, or did they kind of just happen and this universe was created? I mean, it reminds me very much of sort of a Yoknapatawpha kind of situation that you're drawing. And then I checked the Other Electricities website and found that, oh my goodness, there's a good deal more.
Yeah, there is. I had the big plan in mind when I was working on this for about 5 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I left, I'm from the UP, obviously, Upper Michigan.
Yeah.
And when I left that, and I was in Alabama writing, I found myself really missing that snow, but missing it, obviously, in a pretty quirky way. and, you know, not exactly wanting to be there, but just being feeling really attached to and formed by that landscape and the weather patterns and things like that. And so when I was working on the book, I didn't really know what I was doing for a long time. I was originally thinking of it as I was going to write as a textbook for overcoming grief.
Really?
I mean, it wouldn't really be a textbook. It would really be stories or a novel kind of inside the form of a textbook. And a couple of those pieces that I originally wrote for that, the short stories and questions for discussion pieces, are ones that are on the website. and I sort of left those in as this kind of old scaffolding that surrounded what turned into the main text of what I consider a novel, even though I guess the press calls it a book of short stories.
Yeah, yeah. So you're saying...
I mean, that's fair.
Yeah.
Well, I like to think of it as a novel because it really does more... It works better for me thinking about it as one large collection of things, mm-hmm. not as just a bunch of kind of randomly interconnected stories.
You're saying then that in a parallel universe, Other Electricities could have been a self-help book.
It could have, in a way. I'm not exactly sure who it would help, but I do think of... I mean, I think it serves the purpose of the elegy, which is... And the elegy, the form of the elegy, is something that I'm really interested in, and the history of it, sort of in my other life as a poet. And so I think the book is designed to be cathartic, hopefully, and to address what I think are actually really pressing social problems of living in a place as isolated and as economically depressed as the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Well, I will say, to jump off of that whole self-help grief sort of thing, as I've informed you, I'm actually in Northern California, and snow is something of an exotic meteorological phenomenon over here. So I was particularly taken with Big 32, not only because I enjoyed the story, but for me it was a bit educational. So we don't really have snow plows here in San Francisco.
I think that's actually my favorite piece of the book, just because the form of it is kind of great, and I didn't know what I was doing when I wrote the first couple versions of that, but when I realized that structure was something that I could play with, it just like snapped right into place. Which is a great, great feeling as a writer.
Now, there's very, very, I guess, what you might call formalistic sort of stories in here. For example, the organization and formations of blizzards as seen by satellites, which is, very specific. It's almost like a sonnet, the way you have everything structured. I'm wondering, to what extent is this sort of a metrical kind of exercise, and to what extent is it sort of a stunt to prove, hey, I'm Andrew and I can definitely do this?
Well, I mean, there is a little bit of that. I think that, as a writer, you really do sort of need to be constantly raising the bar and trying to, like, to clear that bar. And a lot of my ideas behind some of the pieces in the book were that I'm going to do something ridiculous, right? You know, the story which is in the form of the Abe Sedarian, and see where that can go. And if I could clear that, then I could feel really good about myself, partially, but it also, I think, creates a kind of energy in the book, mm-hmm. where you have this strict form attached to it, but the sort of content, the actual language within it, is really kind of buzzing against the constraint. And I think, there is an element of the book that is critical of its own sort of virtuoso tendencies. Mm-hmm. Because it does have, I think, it's got a little bit of the postmodern attached to it. But I think that I tried to create, partially through some of the structure and form, is something I'm really, really interested in my life as a writer and as a reader, and as a regular person, too.
Yeah.
But I really thought that I was trying to add layers and levels of meaning and structure so readers can get more out of the book. Then, I'm not really delivering entirely just on the straightforward narrative method. And partially that's due to my limitation as a writer. Maybe I'm not good at that. But also that I'm just not as interested in that. So I was trying to find other ways of creating these like lattices of meaning or connections that readers can go to, failing just getting pleasure out of the straight narrative. And I think that there's lots of pleasure in the straight narrative, but for some readers who I've heard from, they're like, why don't you just say what you mean? And, why all the trickeration?
Yeah.
But, for me, it's the trickeration, all that, it's organic to the content of the text. It's this really heady way of taking on this material, and it's, to my mind, inseparable, except for the pieces that, I cut out of the book, some of which are on the website, because they seem too just fun for the sake of fun. And not really getting into anything interesting.
Well, It's interesting that you mentioned that. I mean, for example, if B.R. Myers were to take a look at other electricities, I'm guessing he probably wouldn't approve. Why do you think that there's this sort of ongoing war against experimental or postmodern fiction? And what do you do as a writer who specializes in that to combat it? Or is this something you just largely ignore? Or?
Well, I'm interested in it in the sense in which the market really drives sales of books and sales and acquisitions and really readership. Although, one of the great things about that that happened to me when I wrote this book is that the book actually found its way to a pretty good number of readers, far outstripping my expectations for mm-hmm. it. Because it came out from a small press, mm-hmm. and it's a pretty experimental book. It's the most experimental book that Sarah Band has ever published. And as a result, I think they really felt like they were taking a risk on it. But it's actually sold quite well. It's been gone to a second printing, and not bestseller list or anything like that, but for a small book, it's done well.
Yeah.
And I think that's partially because I've been thinking more and more about this, because I do think of myself as an experimental writer, simply just because I'm not content with the traditional methods of narrative.
Yeah.
But I don't want it to turn into wankery, which I think it does a lot. If you look at a lot of the kind of like white guy experimentalists from the 70s.
Yeah.
Sometimes like Cooper's great, but then sometimes it's just, clearly for the sake of itself. And I feel the same way about Bartholomew and about Gass. And
John Barth is sort of a similar situation
absolutely.
Where, as brilliant as the Sotweed factor is, there's still a couple of those, post-letters novels that are just,
Yeah, they feel perfunctory.
Yeah.
Or, completely wrapped up in their own hermetic ways. And so what I was trying to do in the book is I realized, and it was more experimental even, before it found a publisher. It was originally done as this series, as you might have seen on the webpage. It was done with, three separate books,
mm-hmm.
these, artist books. One of them was just a big index, and they had more images in the text, and they were, a little further out there. But when I was thinking about them as a book, one project that impressed my take on, I was trying to find ways to tighten it and to cut out some of the crap.
Yeah.
That's, I think, the fear when you're writing this sort of work is that if you're just sort of looking at it through your own eyes, wow, of course, everything's awesome. You understand it all. It's fantastic. I'm an awesome writer. But then when you have an editor who's working with you, as I did at Sarah Band, this is Kirby Gann, and he's like, yeah, this really isn't working. You might want to take that out. I'm like, oh, okay.
You know, Kirby Gann was actually one of our nominees the last round. Yeah. Oh, okay. So you've checked out the site then?
Yes, I have before.
Oh, great, great.
Yeah, it's a great project.
Yeah.
But, one thing I was doing with the book is I tried to put in more traditional hooks to give it a little bit more of a connection to a less adventurous audience.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, there's the murder. There's a murder story in the book. There's this love story, admittedly unrequited love story. There's a couple love stories, and there's lots of, still, to my mind, about the human experiences involved in there. So I was trying to add a few elements of pop to go with my more experimental urges, and I feel like it balanced out pretty well.
Well, that sounds very much like David Lynch in Twin Peaks. It wasn't so much about who killed Laura Palmer, it was about the American landscape that was sort of portrayed, and when people started realizing that, that's when the show lost viewers.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, my book name checks Twin Peaks.
Yes.
It's hard not to.
Well, you wear multiple hats, as you had mentioned earlier, as a writer, as a teacher, as an editor, as a poet. I'm wondering what influence the other roles have upon your writing, and maybe specifically this book.
Well, certainly this book wouldn't have been done the way it was without my... because I do a lot of book design also on the side.
Uh-huh.
And I'd originally composed this book pretty much in PageMaker, and I had to take it out of that to get it to Sarah Band so they could actually impose their production process on top of it.
Really? So because they had to put it in Quark?
Well, yeah. I had actually thought about offering to lay the book out myself.
Really?
But I decided that, because, I don't know if you know Mark Danielewski's House of Leaves.
Yes, I love that. I have it here. I love that book.
It's a great book. But do you know the story about that where he had to actually fly in his own time to New New York or wherever to actually typeset the thing himself.
Yeah.
To make sure they got it right, which I love that story. I mean, it's a great story, and it might be apocryphal or whatever. But I thought about doing that with this book, but I decided that it would be better to give up that control and to let their designer do what he would like to do with it, and to make it a little more of a collaboration. Because I enjoy the design work that I do, and the visual elements are another one of these lattices that goes throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really sad, actually, that you don't see more books with visual elements.
Well, the whole...
I mean, now we have all these... we have all the graphic novels happening.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good influence on the publishing world. But even when I was trying to sell this book, I was trying to find an agent for it, then, I mean, I got letters back. It's like, dude, you have graphics in your book. There's no way I'm going to be able to sell it. And I just wanted to respond. I said, you know, have you seen what people are buying? I mean, they're buying Chris Ware. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Why do you think that there's such a stigma against... Well, I was going to ask you about fictional indices, but also, now that we're talking about it, graphic symbols. I mean, for example, Jonathan Safran Foer, he wrote a story in The New Yorker that was all about symbols and all about the sort of semiotics. And it struck me as a particularly sort of, I guess, if gimmicky, but still nevertheless fresh sort of take upon how we view visual icons in our society. Why do you think that, publishing, which, symbols are essentially, they're individual units, much like words. Why do you think there's such a stigma against them?
My guess is it has to do to a certain amount with the workshop model in MFA programs,
uh-huh.
which, pretty much forbids that you have any kind of graphical elements. You have to turn all your stories in double space, regular type. You're not supposed to do any kind of trickeration with the font or anything like that. And I think this is changing, but this has been the traditional model. And if you try to, even use bold or something like that, people are like, you need to show the bold through the words, man.
Yeah.
Which is a problem. But I think it also has to do with just the production models of traditional publishing, where it has not been reasonable for most writers to do, to include graphic elements, because it's been just difficult to do. We've only had PageMaker, for maybe 5 or 10 years?
Yeah.
And so I think that I've got this pet theory that I think writers, now that the technology is more and more transparent, that we're going to have writers who are able to actually do good things with visual elements in a way that they weren't able to do before. And of course, the major publishing industry moves slowly, and so there's this force of tradition. Which maybe is even tied up with things like new criticism and stuff like that, where it's all about the text.
Yeah.
And, it's a bias, but I think it's beginning to change. And even seeing a book like the Danielewski, which was just very exciting to see come out from a huge press, all of a sudden, and there are some that are, Chronicle, of course, is always doing interesting books.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're starting to see more of the graphic novels come through. But it's just a weird bias that people have, that if you put pictures in there, it's less serious as literature.
But I also think it's a stigma that carries over into the arrangement of text. For example, I'm not sure if you have checked out yet The People of Paper.
No, I don't know that at all.
Oh, you should check it out. It's a McSweeney's book, but it was written by Salvador Plasencia. And the amazing thing about this book is that it's arranged in these... three-column chapters, where each particular column over two pages represents a particular perspective. The story is that this guy, he couldn't get it published anywhere until McSweeney's picked it up. So again...
Well, I got that comment a lot, actually, when I was trying to find an agent. A lot of people were like, oh, this is really interesting. No place is going to buy it. You should try McSweeney's.
Huh.
And so, of course, I did try McSweeney's, but they were just too slow. I actually had I got a really nice letter from one of their assistant editors who was passing on to Eggers, who really liked it.
Yeah.
And then I just sat there and didn't hear for a while, and in the meantime, it got picked up by Saraband.
Mm-hmm.
But McSweeney is a real force, I think, towards legitimizing these kinds of projects. Because even if you look at the first couple issues, and I'm not a huge fan of the actual McSweeney's anymore.
Yeah.
But I love what it's done.
Well, it's certainly
issues are just typographically awesome.
Well, yeah, and not only that, but also, you know, for all of my criticisms against it, too, it still managed to, for example, it also published the 7-volume Volman book. So.
Absolutely.
What was I going to ask? Oh, I was going to ask, since we're talking about sort of experimental fiction writers, is B.S. Johnson an influence? What are some of your influences? Gilbert Sorrentino, perhaps? Because he also rearranges text.
You know, I mean, I've never really gotten very far with Sorrentino.
Huh.
And I feel like I've been asked this question before, and my influences tend to be kind of sad in that I don't really like a lot of experimental work for the most part. I mean, what I was thinking about, you know, my publicist was trying to get me to think of books that I could compare my book to.
Yeah.
And I couldn't really come up with anything, which is either egotism or just a lack of reading knowledge.
Yeah.
But there are, I mean, I've always thought, I mean, I've been inspired by people like Charles Baxter.
Yeah.
Who is a very, very traditional writer. But he still tooled around a little bit with form. And with people like Rick Moody, who's done a little bit with that. I'm thinking of his story, Primary Sources, in The Ring of Brightest Angels Around Heaven, mm-hmm. which is in the form of the annotated bibliography, which, yeah, I mean, it was just very, very cool at the time. And then, you know, I mean, even like reaching back to someone like Lawrence Stern.
Yeah.
But I've really had this sort of love-hate with experimental work because a lot of it just doesn't hit me right at all. Just it feels very, again, hermetic. If there's not a reason in the text for it, it's hard to get around to. But then there's people like Georges Perec,
mm-hmm.
who are doing really interesting work. And, I mean, he's someone I actually discovered after I wrote the book. But then if you look at, I mean, the stuff he's doing just in terms of, like, the limitations that they place on prose is pretty exciting stuff.
I wanted to go back to this snow idea of yours and the sort of obsession you have with it or the draw that it has. I'm wondering specifically if you could kind of elaborate upon that further. Is it being plunged into the atmosphere of snow that kind of allows you to create these stories? Is it constantly in the back of your mind? Is it sort of like a very sort of a personal affixation that permits you to sort of like, you know, plow forward, pardon the pun, in this fiction? Or?
I think it's a combination of all those things. I think I'm a very obsessive writer, and the book obviously came out of my obsessions with a couple characters and with the place and with snow. But, I mean, the biggest metaphor, I think, when I think about snow, snow accumulates. I mean, it provides an actual metaphor for the book. In that all these things are just sort of falling down all the time, but they sort of accumulate these interesting structures.
Mm-hmm.
And snow's all about structure. I mean, all the snowflakes have their own structure. And it's something that also, I think, I've always felt under pressure of snow, even when I'm not actually in the UP or being snowed on. Because most of this was written when I was in Alabama,
yeah.
where we don't get much snow at all. But I do think, I mean, it's hard for me to get that out of my mind. And the pressure of the snow, it's always there to wait. It's wait, and it's potentially life-threatening. And it is for people that are still up there, and for me when I was up there, it was overwhelmingly just depressing
mm-hmm.
and oppressing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always there, and it is the thing that put me in the mindset when I could write these stories. And then, of course, you know, trying to riff on various other aspects of the snow idea, too. But it's the essential method that I have, and like it's my one big obsession, I guess. I've got this book of nonfiction now about it, and hopefully I'm going to write my way out of it at some point.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've got this book of essays, which are really, but they're being agented right now.
Yeah.
But they're all about form, and a couple of them are in really kind of crazy forms, like an outline form and some other stuff.
Oh, fascinating. Well, Andrew, the phone is beeping at me, and the last thing I want to do is hang up on you. But thank you so much.
Moon and snow.
C. Max McGee.
Astronaut. A man barely alive. Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability.
ability to make the world's first bionic man.
C. Max McGee
will be that man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger. Faster.
Hello out there in podcast land. Welcome to week number two of the LBC podcast. My name is Edward Champion, and I hope that you are hanging in there. We have, in fact, offered you a considerable amount of Ander Monson-related information over the past week, and showing that, you know, really we're unstoppable, we will be doing the same with Elizabeth Crane this week. So this is the first stroke in an unapologetic tsunami of Elizabeth Crane-related coverage. Anyway, first off, had I known that I would be actually engineering these podcasts during a Saturday night, I might likely have hired a flamenco dancer. Unfortunately, there is no flamenco dancer here. I am quite alone. It's raining outside. I may hire a flamenco dancer next week. I'm not certain. But maybe if you have some ideas as to what kinds of activities might actually pass for flamenco dancing, I would be happy to go ahead and hear them. Anyway, this week's author is Elizabeth Crane. She has authored a book called All This Heavenly Glory, which is a collection of stories put out by Little Brown. Now, this book concerns a character named Charlotte Ann Byers, and the book follows her from childhood all the way into adulthood with all sorts of digressions and asides, and we'll be talking with Miss Crane further about this. Before we actually do that, we will talk with C. Max McGee. He operates the website The Millions, which I do in fact read every day, and I encourage you to do so. And C. Max McGee was kind enough to talk to me for about a minute, so here he is. So I'm here with C. Max McGee, who is the nominator for Elizabeth Crane's All This Heavenly Glory. How are you doing, Max?
I'm doing great.
So what was it about the Crane book that really made it worthwhile for you to nominate?
I think that Elizabeth has a really unique voice that I hadn't really encountered anything quite like it in other books I've read. And that was really what struck me right away when I was reading that book.
What was it about the voice that really sort of struck you?
Well, it's conversational. It's she does a lot of lists and a lot of asides, and you know, at first you think maybe that it's a little a little flighty, but there's a lot of depth there too. She really manages to pack a lot of information into her writing, just by the way that she writes.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Max.
It's very easy.
It's very easy.
Very easy to make mashed potatoes.
Yes, it is, actually.
I'm not really much of a cook, or I might have known that sooner than yesterday, but I just discovered this.
Really? How recently was this?
No, seriously, yesterday I made mashed potatoes for the first time.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I know, they're really easy to make.
Yeah, you kind of just mash them.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
I actually, every Thanksgiving, I'm the designated potato masher.
Oh, is that right?
There's something zen about mashing the hell out of potatoes.
It was great!
Yeah!
I just thought it would be harder, and I thought there would be more things that you had to put into it, and...
You know, people they really don't want to mash potatoes. I don't understand. I like mashing potatoes.
Do you have a potato masher?
Yeah, yeah. I just mash them in a.
That just goes. It like glides through like it's butter.
Oh, okay. I like physically mashing them, but.
Oh.
I don't know. It's sort of like the same reason why I'm obsessed with like you know watching a piece of paper go on fire.
Yes, or why my husband and my stepbrother have something for 15 minutes to discuss about vacuum cleaners.
You know, I mean, if you go into, like, for example, the history of the umbrella, it's actually really interesting. But the guy who bravely opened an umbrella, if it weren't for him, we men would not have actually be using umbrellas, because umbrellas were considered, in their early days, quite feminine. And this guy, Jonas Handy, I believe was his name, He says you guys are completely ridiculous, and he's this philanthropist. And so what he does is he goes ahead and he starts using an umbrella, and the men initially sort of, you know, laugh at him. But 50 years later,
he was dry.
Yes, but he was dry. And 50 years later, the men actually started using umbrellas.
Wow. So that is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And it's only because people like me get obsessed with umbrellas that look these pieces of facts up that. Anyway, okay. Well, let's talk
you
about.
You got your levels now.
Oh yeah, we definitely got the levels. Okay, I'll probably keep that in. Why not? There should be more mashed potato discussion.
Fantastic.
Okay, so anyway, this book, which book is it? All This Heavenly Glory,
yes.
Which I am familiar with. It invited comparisons to me with Elizabeth Mackenzie's Stop This Girl, and not just because you both share the same name, Elizabeth, but it also involved a young girl sort of growing into adulthood. I was wondering, did you swipe the idea from her or?
Actually, apparently we were probably writing them around the same time. They came out around the same time,
yeah.
So we must have been writing them the same time. And actually, not to get too far off track, but she and I and another Elizabeth,
a third Kraken, Elizabeth,
all very not intentionally, yeah. As I'm sure,
yeah,
were commissioned to write stories for Stories on Stage here in Chicago.
Yes,
and it was. It was sort of amusing that the two of us, well, that we were all three named Elizabeth, but that she had, that we had similarly themed short story collection. So the answer is no.
Okay. Well, how did the stories actually come about?
Well, you know, I had written a number of the stories where she's a child.
Yeah.
A while ago. Those were some of the first stories that I'd written. And I always had it in mind to write a complete collection based on that character. And there was a point at which I'd written enough that I sort of thought I might be able to fill in the holes. And I also thought that it might be tedious to have all of the stories be in her childhood, mm-hmm. particularly in the style that I wrote them in. And so I thought, well, let's see, what if we sort of go back and forth between her childhood and her adulthood? And, so I sort of went from there.
Now, where would you draw the line between blatant autobiographical fiction and entirely invented fiction? Because I know that you worked in a video store at one point.
Yes, I did. Well, here, this particular... where would I draw the line? You know, I think that's one of those questions that's so hard to answer. I mean, I can tell you what my experience is. There's a lot of... A great deal of this came out of my own life. I have no issue saying that.
Mm-hmm.
I call it fiction, and I write fiction not just because I make things up, things are exaggerated and things are not necessarily exactly in the right time. I've had an interesting life, I think, and so it lends itself to a lot of ideas, but I've never really been a person who's been able to just sit down and say, oh, when I was six, I sang in the opera, because that's where it ends there for me. It doesn't seem very interesting. But if I sort of twist it into this and that, then I get something that I would rather read. Anyway, I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, Owen Wilson, however, that is very interesting to you.
Well, I had to put in someone that I thought was cute, at least.
Well, you actually, when we emailed, you were kind enough to inform me that Cato Kaelin actually had a television talk show. I had no idea. I'm wondering...
you haven't seen it yet, have you?
Yeah. No, I haven't. I'm too afraid and too busy. But I also, on your blog, I noted that you had a bit of an obsession with Kevin Federline. And I'm wondering, how much does pop culture influence your writing?
Oh, very much. I mean, I'm a kid who totally grew up in front of the TV. Mm-hmm. I'm an only child, and my mom was, she was an opera singer, like the character in the book. So she was away a lot, but even when she was home, I still was just, it was a lot of my entertainment. I mean, hours and hours in front of the TV. It's a wonder I've read anything at all, really. But I think that's true for a lot of people, mm-hmm. A lot of intelligent people. I don't know, something about celebrities and, and certain celebrities, celebrity behavior. It fascinates me what people get away with when they're famous, and that the rules sort of seem to change. And I also, part of the reason I'm interested in Kevin Federline and Britney Spears is because they share a wedding anniversary. They were married on the exact same day that my husband and I were married.
Really?
Yes. And well, so I feel invested in their marriage.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I'm a bit of a slight kind of a numerologist myself. I mean, not in the sense that I subscribe, but I'm very, very obsessed with coincidences along those lines for no
apparent. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know why. Yeah, it's numbers are very, very fun to me. But you know, I'm thinking maybe you might sort of share this slightly pathological sort of distinction.
I don't know if it's a number thing or just a thing that like those two are so clearly different than I am.
Yeah.
You know. You've obviously read Amy Bender's book, by the way.
Yes, I have.
The one about numbers.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, and we talked about that, actually.
Oh, you did? That's
cool. Yeah, so, okay, well, anyway, I guess, well, then how have you managed to sort of wean yourself gradually off of television? I mean, how much do you read, and what are your influences when you actually sat down to write a new sort of story?
Well, a lot of different things. We were actually talking, and I'm teaching a class at University of Chicago right now, fiction workshop, and we were talking about, we went around the room and talked about what inspires us, and, you know, for me, that can be anything. I mean, great fiction constantly inspires me, and I feel like I've been reading lately stuff that I've just been so excited about. From Rick Moody's new book, which I still haven't finished, to I read two stories right before class that I had to change my course packet because I was so excited.
Wow!
One was by Joyce Carol Oates, written sort of in the form of notes. Another one by John Edgar Wideman about this man who's sort of obsessed with his friend's son who's in prison, and his use of language is just like music. There's that, and, you know, I've been watching short films lately, 3-minute films, which seems to be a new genre that I don't know where it came from, but they're something about that form probably appealed to me because they're like short stories.
Film students who didn't have $200,000.
Exactly. But you know, if you know, 3 minutes, you can tell a nice little story in three minutes. Movies and even television. I mean, I saw, like, I'm just going to say this, but I was going to take a nap yesterday and I was flipping channels and Maury Povich came on yet again, and he had on People with Phobias. And this is something that I've been meaning to write a story about for a long time. And, I mean, but weird phobias, you know, like mustard and pickles and balloons. And
the fear of shaving or something like that.
It was a horrifying show because he was purposely trying to torture them with the things that they were afraid of. And it didn't seem very productive at all.
That's terrible.
It was really terrible. That part of it was really, really terrible. But what really interested me was looking at these people's reactions and thinking about, like, how one thing could frighten you so much to the point where you can't leave your house because you're afraid of birds.
Maury Tough Love Povich, man.
No, he was terrible. He's like, stop shaking.
Jesus.
Like, oh my God, that's awful.
This is what is on television these days?
Jeez. Yeah. My God.
That's terrible. I mean, it's fascinating and terrible at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
So I wrote down a ton of notes because I just couldn't believe, like, this one woman is afraid of dogs, and he said, why? And she said, because they're evil demons waiting to just eat you.
Jeez. Well, that's interesting. Well, I mean, there's
anything. Pretty much anything can inspire me. Life, like, continually inspires me. Mashing potatoes.
Yeah.
Honestly,
yeah.
Because the thing that interests me the most about mashing potatoes is that I can work it up in my head that mashed potatoes is such a big deal, and so I'll avoid it and not do it, and then it turns out to be nothing.
Well, as we were sort of establishing earlier, though, there is joy, there is emotion in mashing potatoes.
True.
And as a result, that joy is a human experience that can then be sort of put into fiction.
It's very true. Yeah. It's very true.
Well, anyway, I don't want to digress too much from the literary stuff, but unfortunately, I wanted to talk to you about the story Harold the Filmmaker, which I particularly liked, but this also appeared in Nerve, and I'm wondering how you got involved with Nerve with this.
I can't remember now. It's been a while. I know that they have since then tried to get me to submit some more stuff. I don't write that much that really would fit in with, that was about the only thing that I had to submit to them that seemed remotely related to their content, but I probably at that point I was still just trying to get stories published. Because
mm-hmm.
that was published fairly early on, I think, in my publishing career.
Okay. Well, the thing that's interesting in this is that in addition to in this book, is that in addition to sort of motifs such as Owen Wilson, you also have, you know, pornography, a mother dying of cancer. I'm wondering, how much does the juxtaposition of what might be called sort of, you know, I don't know, pedantic motifs with very sort of human motifs, how much are you concerned with that?
You know what? I don't think about it too much. I think more about honestly, I just think about what interests me. And hopefully, when I start to really look at something that seems to be turning into a collection, then I start to look at, do they fit together? Do the themes and the stories cohere? And in this one in particular, since it's one character, like, I wanted to have some semblance of a progression in her life. And so I don't worry about it too much. I kind of just hope that the style and the theme and everything will somehow glue together. We were watching, I blogged about this a little bit, but we were watching a PBS thing about artists recently, and I was very amused by Andy Warhol's answer, you know, to some question about how do you go about, you know, what do you think about the importance of your work or whatever it was? And he was just like, can I just say, because sometimes the answer is, I don't know.
Well, I should point out that I read that you published a letter in the New York Times decrying the existence of the blueberry bagel.
Yes.
What do you say to someone who says, come on, Elizabeth, do such issues really need to be talked about and written about?
Well, my letters to the New York Times were always in response to something that was, you know, something on the op-ed page or whatever. And there was somebody else who had written some op-ed piece about the blueberry bagel. And I felt very understood that these things shouldn't be mixed, and so I wrote it.
Why? What's wrong with that? If people
I
want...
I don't think that fruit and like, it's sweet and savory together. It's not really my thing. And bagels go with cream cheese. You don't want cream cheese on your blueberry bagel. That's just weird.
Yeah, it is a bit weird, but...
now, since then, they've put all kinds of weird things in bagels.
Pumpkin bagels, that's...
Yeah,
that's that I don't get.
That's what muffins are for. That's
chocolate
what
chip bagels. What's up with that, you know? Anyway, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, the lists and the data and the footnotes and the phrasing actually reminded me very much of David Foster Wallace.
Well, that's nice.
And in fact, you also share Mr. Wallace's publisher, Little Brown.
Yes,
now,
we do.
I do note that there was an essay that you wrote in Pals about this, but how much of an influence is Wallace? And do you think that possibly shaking off the influence is a burden for you in terms of developing your voice more?
It's not something I really think of consciously. Wallace and Rick Moody and a couple of other people are actually authors who I came to sort of later. And what kind of blew my mind, just because this was how I had been writing letters to people,
mm-hmm.
but not, it didn't occur to me that I could do that in my fiction.
Mm.
And it was really revelatory for me when I found out that people were doing this. And so I think that basically if anybody wants to compare me to him, that's great. I'm not even worried that I'm going to be in that category ever. But I think really what he reading him does for me more than anything is just give me license to write how I naturally write. And thank God.
But let's say that there's a particularly sort of stingy B.R. Myers type who reads an Elizabeth Crane book and says, well, you know what, this came after David Foster Wallace, and Wallace has mined this territory, and thus it's proprietary, and Crane looks like it's a knockoff here. What would you say to that?
That's fine. You know, I realize that he didn't pioneer footnotes. I know that.
No.
As well.
No. Well, obviously.
Which makes me feel a little bit better about it.
Yeah.
And also, you know, there's a point at which criticism, you kind of just have to not take it too personally. I mean, they just, Michiko Kakutani?
Yes.
Just referred to she gave him a glowing review for his new book of essays.
Yeah.
But within this review, she referred to his previous two short story collections as being throwaways.
Yeah, yeah. I remember
this. And if, you know, if she's calling David Foster Wallace two of his books throwaways, granted, that's in the context of him being a genius or whatever.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, if that's the case, I aspire to be a throwaway.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm sort of suggesting here is because, like, there's a lot of similar sort of phrasings in your writing and his. And so I'm wondering if you ever feel that there is, like, maybe I'm channeling him too much, or maybe I need to write in a way that is not quite so explicitly formed with these long, lengthy sentences and these with regard tos and all that.
I don't worry about it too much.
Okay.
I don't worry about it too much. I think my long sentences are different than his long sentences and probably not nearly as smart and... The one concession I have sort of made is that I probably won't do too many footnotes in the future.
You know, there are no footnotes that aside from that one story in this book by comparison. So.
Yeah, and there were some in a couple of others, and I actually there weren't too many, and so I just sort of put them in parens, so that people wouldn't be so distracted by the David Foster Wallace thing.
Actually, though,
I think that my publishers probably took me in spite of that and not because of it.
Actually, though, the thing that I think that one of Wallace's weaknesses is that he doesn't actually really put things into parenthetical statements. And actually, sometimes, though, when it's like a footnote and you go all the way to like the back of the book or whatever, or, you know, down below, and it's like three words, it's like, why did I go to all that trouble when you could just put it in parentheses, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
So maybe you might be able to kind of innovate on the parenthetical front. Where he
perhaps
has innovated on the footnote front.
Perhaps.
Okay. Let's see here.
It's all digression to me. I mean, footnotes are technically supposed to be... To me, it's just all another place to put digression.
Why do you think there's such a war on digression in postmodernism?
I don't know. I don't know. I think it's a really... I think it's a really natural way to... The mind works.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, conversationally speaking, I mean, you think there's almost like this resistance to reproducing explicit conversation within the actual text or prose of a book? Or,
huh.
I don't know, that's a theory.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it.
You know, like if we put like gosh and gee willikers or other sort of asides, like, you know, in the text, I mean, yes, they become very prominent because we expect a very formalistic kind of textual approach. We expect our plotting and our like... Yes,
exactly.
The room is smoky dark.
Who I'm helping do a little bit of editing on her second novel right now.
Oh, who?
A friend of mine.
Oh, okay. I thought you might mention a name and I didn't hear it. Damn it!
Well, I don't want to give any public criticism of her.
Okay.
She's a really great writer. But she has a habit of putting, by the way, an awful lot.
Really?
And I don't know that it's something people say it that much.
Hmm. By the way, yeah, I think people say
you
that.
You do?
I don't know. I mean, you know what, actually, though? This may be a parochial kind of thing. I mean, at least the people here in California, particularly like the intellectual crowd, we always say, oh, and by the way, in a sort of kind of... I don't know why. I mean, it's sort of like... It's kind of like the... It depends on what the context you're using it in. I hate to ramble about this, but
mm-hmm.
you know, when you're going ahead and, like, you want to go ahead and give them someone a piece of information... Like, you know, at the last minute and surprise them, then, oh, and by the way, is like the perfect thing to say.
I think this is more in the context of trying to change, like, switch the conversation to a different line of discussion. And it seemed awkward to me. That's, you know what I mean?
Okay.
Now I'll have to look at it again.
Yeah, well, actually, no, but I mean, no. But the thing, the point here is that we can go ahead and say these things within quote marks, but we can't actually say them explicitly, sort of in the text. And I, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe there's something going on here. Maybe that's why the people who might decry your work as David Foster Wallace derivative. Maybe what we're really sort of talking about here is a sort of resistance to this in text. I don't know.
I have no idea. I have no idea.
Okay, well, we'll go to another topic then. Daniel Green, who is actually one of the members of the Litblog Co-op, he has pointed out that When the Messenger is Hot was frequently categorized in the chick lit section. Now, does the chick lit thing bother you at all? Or
I'm technically not supposed to talk about it because I posted on my blog several months ago. And I actually, the headline was C blank 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 K L blank T.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of made a public vow never to use those words together
mm-hmm.
again. But it bothers me not, you know, partly for myself, but more because it just seems so dismissive.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what I do. I would be. And part of the reason I don't think that's what I do is because if I did, I would be making a lot more money. Because those books apparently sell. I just think it reduces the potential quality of a work. You know, like any sort of heading like that might do. But I had a bee in my bonnet about it a while back.
Yeah, but at the same time, the thing about the chick lit term is that it really isn't entirely specific. It means different things to different people.
Right.
And if there's any sort of commonality, it's the whole notion that if you write about women's issues and you
right.
are a woman writer in
right.
any way, that you are all of a sudden chick lit. Doesn't
right.
matter if you are, you know, Curtis Sittenfeld, who doesn't really care for the term and is a little bit more dismissive of certain authors, or if you are,
yeah, right.
you know, or if you are, you know, even Doris Lessman, you know.
I think that those themes, I mean, so why isn't a book by a man about a man? Very little of it is called, like, referred to as dick lit.
Yeah.
Although that term is out there, it's not used widely.
Well, dick lit doesn't sell. I mean, Kyle Smith's Love Monkey, men don't like to read about. Apparently, anyway, men don't like to read about their own sort of male anxieties. Although there is the new Nick Laird book that's out, Utterly
Who?
Monkey. Nick Laird?
I don't know it.
Oh, it's, Nick Laird, now I'm suspicious.
Oh, Nick Laird, yeah.
Yeah, Zadie Smith's husband.
Right, right.
She, apparently, he has a new book called Utterly Monkey, and it's all about, you know, male sort of, you know, whatever, 20s, 30s, blah, blah, blah. So
I think it's supposed to be good, isn't it?
I've heard it's good, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, going back to this, though, I mean, yeah, I mean, why, I was going to ask you, like, how we actually sort of defeat this particular sort of, you know, paradigm, but I've explored that question far too many times. Instead, I'm going to ask you, how do you think this affects you as a writer? Do you think that the chick lit sort of labeling really kind of undermines your contributions to letters?
Well, you know, it's not. I mean, I do what I do, so I try not to concern myself too much with how it's perceived. I take some consolation in the fact that the way that I see it is that most of the reviews that I've gotten for both books, for the first one I think more so even,
mm-hmm.
Have usually when those two words come up, the C and the L,
yeah.
It tends to be like, the quote will be something like, it's too bad that she gets lumped into this category.
Mm-hmm.
Or it would be dismissive to say this is what she is, you know, to use this to describe her work, because it's deeper than that. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And also I know that that's not how my publishers have thought of me or marketed me. So, you know, in the end, I just do what interests me and what I can do, and I can't really control how it's seen.
Two last questions. But the first one, to jump off of this, as a woman writer, do you feel that there are hurdles in the publishing industry, particularly because you write in a particularly stylistic manner, that prevents you from sort of preserving and maintaining this distinctive voice? Do you come up with a lot of opposition?
No. Okay. No, I think that's been a real advantage to me. I mean, I didn't really even know. I was the sort of writer who had written up until I started reading people who wrote stylistically differently. I thought that I had to write in a really sort of neat, very straightforward way, and I didn't realize that I had room to write in a way that felt natural to me. With my first book, it was surprising how quickly I found a publisher. I'm not too worried about it. I think there's always room for good writing, and I hope that I'll continue to write stuff that people like enough to put it out there.
Now, I understand that you basically fled from New York to Chicago. I'm wondering how much of the Charlotte Anne stories was a purging of this sort of the New York fears or whatever.
a lot of it, yeah. I mean, my creative life is really rocketed here in a way that it couldn't in New York, because I was constantly worried about money, mm-hmm. Paying the rent, and that and the physicality of New York just did not agree with me. It took me so long to get out of there. Mm. But Chicago is so much less of a claustrophobic city. Mm-hmm. And being able to see out windows and see the sunshine and be able to afford to do more than just stay in my apartment, because that's all I had money for.
Now, come on, you haven't really considered the aesthetics of the brick wall now, you know? When you open up the window and see it, it's actually, there's more going on there.
I don't miss it that much. Yeah. I really don't. So that's a very big aspect of my story and hers, definitely.
Okay. Well, Elizabeth, I have another author to talk with, but thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And